Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and at 13 hours GMT on Friday the 5th of June, these are our main stories. A court in Australia has prevented a planned march for racial justice because of the coronavirus. Government troops in Libya have made a major gain in their struggle against rebel fighters. May 2020 was the hottest on record, so what does this mean for the world? Also in this podcast,
the topic of conversation at this point is only about this issue. The momentum continues to grow. And this is not only black people who are sounding this alarm.
Renowned athlete Michael Johnson says leading sportsmen and women should tackle injustice following the killing of George Floyd in police custody. And the rugby players who spent a very long time away from home, all because of COVID-19. In the days following the death of the African-American George Floyd in police custody in Minneapolis, people around the world have been marching in solidarity, with campaigners calling for justice for him and other black men and women. There were plans for a protest in Sydney in Australia, but the authorities applied for an emergency court order to ban it because of the coronavirus. Today, New South Wales Supreme Court Judge Justice Fagan ruled that the march can't go ahead.
For the court to authorise a gathering in these circumstances would amount to a defiance of a judgment that has been made by ministers in the government and the public health officials who advise them in the interests of the safety of all.
Our correspondent in Sydney, Shaima Khalil, told me the reasoning behind that decision.
The judge who was presiding over this, Justice Desmond Fagan, basically said that it would be a public safety risk allowing the protest to go ahead. He described it as defiance of decisions made by the authorities based on expert health advice. He did acknowledge the right of Indigenous activists and families to protest. He acknowledged the importance of the Black Lives Matter rallies, especially in drawing attention to the treatment of Indigenous Australians. But he did make the point that many other Australians had had to sacrifice rights during the pandemic, including attending places of worship, forfeiting their livelihood. Some people have lost their jobs. And when you stack this against the current circumstances, he came to the decision that this rally should be banned. I must say that organizers, even as the court was deliberating, and even before that, they had made it very clear to us when we were outside the Supreme Court that they would attend protests regardless of the legal decision.
That's going to be a difficult one for the authorities, isn't it?
It's a really, really difficult balance and a dilemma for not only the politicians, the ministers and the premiers, but also the police force as well. Because, you know, in the past few weeks, Australia has been the definition of a success story. They've had a really good looking curve, if you will, in controlling the spread of the virus. And that has encouraged them to open up the economy very, very gradually with the control over the numbers of people that are gathered at any given place to consolidate the achievements that they've made. And now they're faced with the one thing they do not want to happen. Thousands and thousands of people all congregating on the same place, all wanting to be there at the same time, not just in New South Wales, in Melbourne as well, in Victoria. Both those demonstrations now at risk being fined. We've just had the ban here in New South Wales. It's worth saying, though, Valerie, that in other states in Australia, in other cities, in Queensland, for example, and in South Australia, protesters had been given exemptions to rally in those protests because they haven't had any cases for quite some time now.
And this issue, Shaima, of racial discrimination in policing, that's very pertinent in Australia, isn't it? This isn't just about solidarity with what's been going on in the US.
No, this really hits close to home for many Aboriginal families who've lost loved ones in police custody. When I was outside court, I spoke to Litona Dungay, David Dungay's mother. He's a young man who died in police custody in almost similar circumstances to George Floyd, saying exactly the same last words, "I can't breathe." And she was very emotional when she spoke to me, saying, I do know how they feel. I know exactly how they feel. And that's why we want to protest. But also, I think it's because this issue hasn't gotten the attention that it deserved, according to those families. It hasn't been part of the national conversation. And they're using the momentum and the impetus of what's happening in the United States to highlight those issues here in Australia.
Shaima Khalil. The forces of Libya's UN-backed government have taken control of the town of Tahouna. It's another highly significant advance for them. Our Middle East analyst Alan Johnston reports.
The town of Tahouna was the last stronghold of the warlord General Khalifa Haftar in the west of Libya. It was a launchpad for his attempt to capture the nearby capital, Tripoli, and bring the whole country under his sway. The loss of Tahouna has brought the general's ambitions to an end, at least for now. Despite being heavily backed by Russia, the UAE, Egypt and others, General Haftar has suffered a string of defeats in recent weeks. His opponents on the government side have been significantly strengthened by Turkish military support.
Alan Johnston. Brazil has one of the fastest growing rates of coronavirus. It now has the third highest number of deaths in the world after the United States and UK. The health ministry says so far more than 34,000 Brazilians have lost their lives with COVID-19. Nick Miles told me more.
For 3 days in a row, new records were set for the number of people who died. 1,500 people died across the country on Thursday. That's more than one every single minute. And there are particular problems, strangely, in the northern state of Amazonas. You might have thought that the biggest city there, Manaus, which is deep inside the Amazonian jungle, thousands of kilometres away from big cities. You would have thought that that would be less affected, but it's got hugely densely populated shanty towns and the hospitals are overwhelmed. The authorities have even turned their schools into makeshift field hospitals, full of intensive care beds. Well, Ricardo Nicolau is in charge of them.
We are now working with 163 beds. I could reach 279 beds. That's the estimate of our maximum capacity, using every single space available. Every other day, new beds become available and they are automatically taken by a new patient.
So what has the Brazilian president Jair Bolsonaro been saying about this? Well, not very much, actually. He's been speaking on Facebook Live, once again expressing his frustration, not with the numbers, but with the isolation measures imposed across the country by the state governments. He said that the collateral damage, hunger and unemployment from this virus would be far worse than those who'd lost their lives from it.
And Peru is another badly hit country in South America, isn't it, Nick?
Yeah, it's strange. Peru was very quick to put down restrictions on movement across the country. It closed its borders. But despite that, 5,000 people have died, the second largest number in South America. And many people are putting that down to the fact that a lot of poor Peruvians simply can't stay at home. They don't have refrigerators. There are huge shanty towns sort of snaking up the arid hills outside Lima. And many people have come down with problems there. Hospitals are even running low on oxygen. And the government, the president, Martin Vizcarra, has said that its use is now for healthcare only. It's a priority over industrial use.
Nick Miles. One recurring subplot in the global coronavirus story has been the often wildly varying views on an anti-malaria drug some believe could protect against the onset of COVID-19. Brazil's President Jair Bolsonaro is a fervent believer, and in the US, Donald Trump has taken hydroxychloroquine himself. But some scientists are sceptical. So, when a large-scale study appeared to bolster suspicions that the medicine could be dangerous for some COVID-19 patients, the World Health Organization halted trials. But now, three authors of that study have retracted their findings, which were published in the British medical journal, The Lancet. Melissa Davey of The Guardian newspaper has been investigating and told Carney Sharp what she discovered.
Initially, it was a really impressive-looking study involving 96,000 patients in 671 hospitals worldwide, and it did find higher risk of death and heart problems in patients who were given hydroxychloroquine, the drug, if they had COVID-19. Now, since then, there have been massive questions raised by the global research community about the data. I initially wrote about issues identified with the Australian data, which didn't seem to add up to me or a couple of experts I was speaking to. And since I wrote the story, it snowballed from there. Researchers all around the world are saying the data for their countries doesn't add up either or match up with their clinical experience.
Okay, so what does the data from Australia and the other countries, what is that showing?
One of the things we noticed about the Australian data is the hospitalised patients in Australia captured by the study were more patients than had been in hospital in Australia at the time, according to government data, hospital data. I've obviously been reporting on COVID-19 in Australia since the pandemic began, and we get daily updates about how many patients are in hospital and that kind of thing. It was confusing to me how this study had captured more patients than we knew existed at the time. So I began asking hospitals and researchers about whether they were part of this database used by the study, this amazing database that seemed to capture in almost real time data from patients all over the world. And it became apparent that there were other flaws in the study as well. For example, hospitals in Africa that just don't have the resources to be part of a database like this, and doctors saying that they've never heard of it.
One wonders then, how can a respected medical journal like The Lancet get it so wrong?
There have been other studies which have raised real concerns. It was also The Lancet that published the paper that very wrongly linked vaccines to autism. Now, that paper was retracted years ago, but it's still being used by the anti-vaccination community to try and prove their point. So even once a paper is retracted, it can still have massive implications. There is a peer review process that papers do undergo, but with COVID-19 and the fact that it's a terrible disease with no effective treatment, there is a rush to publish studies about COVID-19. Yeah. They still go through peer review, but there are questions now about what is that process and how much has it been rushed?
Journalist Melissa Davey from The Guardian newspaper speaking there to Carney Sharp. And in a statement, The Lancet said there were many outstanding questions about the firm and the data allegedly included in the study. The world experienced the hottest May on record, according to new figures from the European Union's Copernicus Climate Monitoring Network. Our environment analyst Roger Harabin told me more about the report's findings.
Well, in a way, this is just a continuation of what has become the new business as usual. We're putting so much carbon dioxide emissions and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere that temperature records are being broken all the time. So this is kind of routine. I don't mean to say that it isn't worrying. It is very worrying for climate scientists, but absolutely predicted this sort of thing. So May in the statistics were May was 0.63 degrees Celsius warmer than the long-term average. What's interesting is where the readings are the very highest were in Alaska, Antarctica and Siberia. And Siberia, as you remember, has suffered huge wildfires over the past month. The entire region is drying out. And very seriously, you know, this massive oil spill which is underway at the moment in Siberia may have been caused by the melting of permafrost, the permanently frozen ground underneath the oil tank. That is not yet confirmed. But if it is confirmed, it really sends an alarm bell for lots of infrastructure across the Arctic, which has been built on the assumption that the ground will remain frozen, and it is not remaining frozen.
So that means it's possibly, the infrastructure is possibly crumbling?
Infrastructure in many places is crumbling in the Arctic, and we've seen that already. But if we're going to have things like this massive oil spill resulting from it, that really is going to cause people a pause for thought, I think, and especially interesting for the Russians, who have always been rather recalcitrant players in climate change talks. You know, major exporters of gas, of course, had wedded to the fossil fuel economy, and seeing possible benefits from warming up of parts of Russia. And it may be here they're seeing some of the serious disbenefits.
Well, you've said we've heard this before. This is what climate scientists expect. Is anything going to change?
Well, I mean, things are constantly surprising us. And what's really surprising scientists at the moment is what's happened in the UK. So in the UK, we have gone from a record wet February to a record sunny spring. And our sunshine records for May are higher than all other May sunshine records on record, and higher than three records for the summer. So we've had an absolutely extraordinary month. If you were imagining it as a 100 metres race, this May has beaten the previous record May by over 11 metres.
I mean, it's absolutely massive, and scientists are just aghast at it. They don't know what the implications are. They don't know if it's to do with man-made climate change. But we've been speaking to climate scientists who are saying, look, you know, we know about long-term changes. It's the world's getting hotter. We know that. Short-term weather forecasting is now really good. And they're saying what we want now is some of the billions that have gone to space exploration recently, some of those billions to be spent on better forecasting so we have a better idea of these weather extremes that have been hitting the UK and other places.
Roger Harabin, our environment analyst. Still to come in this edition of our podcast.
At the GNR Postgraduate Medical Centre, all the beds are full. In fact, only a handful are available across the city of 15 million people.
The immense challenges facing Pakistan as it emerges from coronavirus lockdown against the advice of many doctors. The Kenyan authorities have banned all single-use plastics such as water bottles and straws from national parks, beaches, forests and other protected areas. It comes 3 years after the country announced one of the world's strictest bans on plastic bags, as Will Ross reports.
In a normal year, without the coronavirus, around 2 million tourists head to Kenya in search of spectacular wild animals and some sunshine. When tourism restarts, they'll have to be careful what they carry. It may be fine to leave a European airport with a plastic water bottle in hand, but it won't be allowed once they get to the national park or beach resort. The Kenyan government is encouraging more environmentally friendly alternatives, so a refreshing cocktail by the Indian Ocean may well be sipped through a straw made of bamboo.
Will Ross. In Pakistan, doctors are warning the already weak healthcare system could soon be overwhelmed by coronavirus patients. So far, with fewer than 2,000 deaths, the outbreak there hasn't been as bad as some had feared. But with shops and businesses reopening, the rate of new cases and new deaths is at its highest levels. Staff at a number of major hospitals have told the BBC they're running out of critical care beds, as Secunda Kamani reports.
In Karachi's hospitals, intensive care units for coronavirus patients are under pressure. At the GNR Postgraduate Medical Centre, all the beds are full. In fact, only a handful are available across the city of 15 million people. Local officials are racing to build new facilities, but they, along with doctors, have been frustrated by the central government's decision to ease lockdown restrictions last month.
We are definitely frustrated because on one hand you are fighting corona.
Dr. Yaya Tunio is the deputy director of the hospital.
We have noticed there is a sudden surge of cases after the easing of lockdown. Our medical services have been stretched to their limit. We have not been able to manage our cases and we have been diverting our cases to other hospitals.
Streets and markets in Pakistan are crowded. Officials say anyone breaking social distancing rules or not wearing a face mask can be fined. However, enforcement is likely to be difficult. With the number of deaths rising but still comparatively low, Prime Minister Imran Khan has been clear. He believes the threat to the economy is bigger than the threat posed by coronavirus. There are 50 million people here who can't even afford two meals a day, he said in a televised address earlier this week. If we impose a lockdown like they did in Wuhan or Europe, what will happen to them? But critics say the government's messaging is confused and the public are not taking the virus seriously enough. A number of hospitals have been attacked by the angry relatives of patients, fired up by conspiracy theories suggesting doctors are being paid by the World Health Organization to wrongly declare people COVID positive. In some of the incidents, families have forcibly tried to take away the bodies of their dead relatives in order to give them traditional and large funerals. Other scuffles have been triggered in part by a lack of resources. Dr. Rizwan Sehgal works at the Mayo Hospital in Lahore.
When a patient requires a ventilator and we tell them that we do not have a vacant ventilator and try to shift them to another hospital, they start doubting our intent. They start questioning that whether we want to treat a patient or not. They believe that we are creating this situation just to gain something out of it. This is really saddening to know that people have this mistrust on us.
Healthcare workers face other threats too. At least 30 have died from coronavirus. Hundreds have been infected. Doctors have complained about a lack of protective equipment for some staff. Officials, meanwhile, insist PPE stocks are improving and say while some hospitals are filling up across the country, capacity remains high. But for now, the number of new cases is continuing to rise.
Secunda Kermani reporting. The life of a top sportsman or woman means a lot of time spent away from home. But one Samoan rugby team's journey back to their families from an away fixture is still in progress, more than 80 days after the match and more than 100 days since leaving Samoa. Jonathan Savage has the story.
After 40 minutes of hard-fought rugby, things were going well for Manuma Samoa. They were beating South China Tigers in the Australian city of Perth by 18 points to 17. That moment, just before 5pm on the 14th of March, was as good as it got. It was the very next day that Samoa said anyone travelling from a list of 33 countries must self-quarantine for 2 weeks before they set off. Number 33 on that list was Australia. It was going to take a lot more than a driving maul to get through their own nation's defence against COVID-19. The squad got as far as New Zealand, where luckily their pre-match training base, a church compound, was still free. During that quarantine period, the Samoan government went further and closed their border completely. Manuma Samoa were stuck. And not stuck in luxury either. 20 large men sharing a single dormitory. We're told that some of them snore. "I imagine this is what a prisoner feels like," said team manager Tuala Patliota. Finally, a week ago, after several false starts, the players were able to return to Samoa. But the saga still isn't over. After they landed on home soil, they were put in another quarantine for 2 weeks. Now they're dotted around the island in multiple hotels. They still haven't been able to see their loved ones. And that match against South China Tigers, the one they were winning at half-time, they ended up losing by 52 points to 27. At least Manuma Samoa have had plenty of time to figure out what went wrong.
Jonathan Savage. More videos have emerged in the US of apparent police brutality during the protests over the death of George Floyd. In the city of Buffalo in New York State, two police officers have been suspended after footage showed them shoving an elderly man to the ground. Speaking to the BBC, the African-American Olympic champion Michael Johnson says the fallout from the death of George Floyd has convinced him that the world's leading athletes must use their platform to call for change.
We've seen black men killed by police before, and we've seen those police convicted and sent to prison, but it still didn't change anything. We're still seeing it happen. You know, the difference this time is the protests continue. The topic of conversation at this point is only about this issue. The momentum continues to grow. And this is not only black people who are sounding this alarm. This is everyone who understands fairness and they're demanding change. And so I'm hopeful that a year from now, we're not looking back at this time and nothing has happened. I'm hopeful that change truly does come, and I'm hopeful that, honestly, we can sustain this through the November elections when a lot of people who typically support this type of movement have not voted, and that's a problem. And the biggest hammer you can swing at this is going to the ballot box and voting.
I'm reading between the lines that you're also, in a way, encouraging people to vote against the current president. Is there a viable alternative? If change comes in, does America change?
Let me be clear. Let me be absolutely clear. You don't have to read between the lines. We need to vote this president out of office. He is a huge part of this problem. It is a problem that we have had for decades. From the day that he entered office, before he entered office, he has sought to divide the country. He has sought to stoke this racial divide. He shows no compassion. He shows no understanding. And he does not care about fairness or the need for this country to heal, the need for this country to work together, that does not matter to him.
Michael Johnson speaking there to Chris Latcham. And finally, time now for our weekly news from elsewhere, when we look at some of the less reported stories from around the world. Joining me is Crassey Twigg from our monitoring team, which follows news media in many languages. And Crassey, you've been following the gradual reopening of many societies that have been in a coronavirus lockdown and some of the trends emerging, which might give us an idea about what the new normal might be. So what can you tell us?
Well, one of the common themes is a new push for green recovery in big cities. Now, this isn't particularly new. Urban authorities have started thinking about it over the last few months. And the observation is being made in many cities that the pandemic has achieved what climate activists have not even dared to dream about: empty streets and clean air. So naturally, many people want to keep this in the post-COVID world. And there's the sense that the crisis could be a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to change things and that we simply cannot go back to business as usual.
So how are things being changed?
The most recent example is from the Greek city of Athens, which this week banned traffic in the town centre for the next 3 months. This is related to a cautious opening for tourism, and the thinking behind it is that with no cars, there'll be more space for pedestrians to observe social distancing. But this is also a part of a much bigger plan of a major overhaul of the town centre. It's called the Grand Walk of Athens, which will see big chunks of the city centre being turned into pedestrian zones. And the city of Milan in Italy recently announced plans to introduce a major scheme relocating street space from cars and giving it to cycling and walking. So about 35 kilometres of streets will be transformed over the summer. There's also a lot of talk about how technology can be used for this green recovery. And one idea that experts in Germany, for example, are discussing is the introduction of adaptive traffic lights that can quickly react to specific traffic situations and to change in traffic flows.
And Crassey, after months of a cultural void, we're now seeing a resumption of performances in new venues, the outdoors. What are the best examples you've found?
Well, last week, a theatre production was staged in the courtyard of a nursing home in eastern France, which apparently was the first professional theatre production in the country since March. It's called Cabaret Under the Balconies, and it was performed literally for an audience scattered on balconies and the courtyard. There have been similar performances in the Czech Republic, where a parking lot was used for a theatre play. And there are plans for such outdoor plays in many other places over the coming months. Those are expected to be compact events, so that there's distance between the spectators, which also means that tickets might be a bit pricier. And Bulgaria announced plans to build a big covered outdoor area outside the National Culture Palace in the capital Sofia, so that all kinds of events can take place there.
And another new trend is a bit of a throwback, isn't it? The revival of the drive-in cinema.
Yes, there is a lot of excitement about this one, actually, because for many people, this will be their first taste of retro Americana. And one headline in the British press described it as the one good thing to come out of all this. So these are mushrooming everywhere, including the least expected places like Iran, where they have been banned since the Islamic Revolution in 1979, because they afforded too much privacy to unmarried couples. The drive-in theatre now operates from a parking lot in Tehran, showing a film in line with the views of hardliners. And also, a drive-in disco is now a thing after a nightclub in Germany held an auto disco in May, where the visitors danced in their car seats, honking their car horns and waving glow sticks. And it all looked like they were having fun.
Glad to hear it. Thanks very much there to Crassey Twigg from our monitoring team for bringing us this week's news from elsewhere. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or any of the topics we've covered in it, do send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.